its allies have achieved from the war.
American and NATO forces have finally left Afghanistan's Bagram Air Base, the hub of the US military operations in the country for nearly 20 years. The pullout marks a symbolic end to what US President Joe Biden has called Washington's forever war. It comes after Biden announced earlier this year his decision to withdraw all US forces from Afghanistan by the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. The pullout has been welcomed by the Afghan people.
This is good news that the Americans left Bagram. The Americans had reached an agreement with the Taliban in Doha, and these agreements must be implemented. And this is for the good of Afghanistan.
God willing, there will be peace in this country. We want peace until the end. God is merciful, and we hope that one day there will be peace in our country.
The Taliban militant group has also welcomed the withdrawal as a positive step. The group's spokesman said the full withdrawal of foreign forces will pave the way for Afghans to decide about their future themselves. In February 2020, the administration of former President Donald Trump struck a deal with the Taliban to withdraw all US troops from Afghanistan by May 2021. Joe Biden rescheduled the date and set September 11th for the pullout. The US and its NATO allies invaded Afghanistan in October 2001 under the pretext of the so-called War on Terror. The Taliban militant group was removed from power following the invasion. However, after nearly two decades, the US invasion failed to uproot the militant group, and Washington had to finally sit at the negotiating table with the group. According to the Pentagon, the US military operations in Afghanistan have cost nearly $825 billion. Also, according to US media reports, more than 2,400 US military personnel have been killed in Afghanistan. The US war in Afghanistan has left thousands of Afghan civilians dead and caused a significant damage to the country's infrastructure. And now, with the prospect of an end to the war, which though failed to bring security to the country, calls will certainly get louder for the prosecution of American troops and officials involved in the war crimes against the Afghan people.
Well, joining us on this edition of The Spotlight, we have Mr. Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition, who's joining us from San Francisco. Also, we have journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas, who's with us from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Becker in San Francisco. Mr. Becker, tell us how significant this withdrawal from the Bagram Air Base is, in your opinion.
Well, it's very significant in that, as was said in your lead, Bagram has been the kind of the hub of U.S. war efforts there. We also have to remember that Bagram is a torture center. That's not talked about very much now, but people died there under torture and suffered terribly under torture by CIA and other U.S. operatives. Bagram has been really the symbol of the U.S., the latest U.S. intervention. And, you know, we do have to point out that the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan once before. It wasn't the open armed forces as it is now. But the CIA operation that began in 1979 ended only with the fall of the Soviet Union, which was in 1991. And during that 12 years, the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan, which was the largest CIA intervention ever up until that point, and maybe up to this point, created the conditions for the terrible conditions that plague Afghanistan down till today, and with this latest withdrawal of U.S. forces. Of course, we don't know what the disposition is of, in addition to the U.S. forces, the many thousands of mercenary troops, contractors, who are in Afghanistan and from the United States and from other countries who are being paid by the Pentagon.
Mr. Abbas, symbolically, this does represent something significant, but what about the immediate impact of the withdrawal? As we know, Bagram is strategically vital and important, too.
Well, the immediate impact will be that the Taliban will, I guess, reckon that the Americans are getting serious about leaving, because, of course, there's been a huge upsurge in takeover of various provincial areas by the Taliban as soon as they heard that Biden was planning to not leave till September of 2021. So it does seem as there's been a lot of activity, a lot of terror attacks, and a lot of movement in various provinces by the Taliban forces. In fact, what we've seen is Afghan government forces literally surrendering without much of a fight in many, many areas. And that immediate impact could be that the Taliban would refrain from launching further attacks, perhaps. The Americans may be hoping for that. But, of course, the overview of this war is that at its peak, the U.S. and NATO military numbers surpassed 150,000. I think they're looking at something like 6,500 to be there now. Goodness knows what it'll be in reality by the time they actually leave. The conflict has cost America more than $2 trillion, according to a Brown University analysis, and more than 2,500 American servicemen members were killed. I mean, a lot more than that probably by now. These are figures from maybe a year or two back. But along with scores of allied troops, humanitarian workers, journalists, and tens of thousands of civilians, these have all been casualties of war. And let's not even begin to mention the number of Afghans that have been killed. I mean, it's diabolical, the kind of American terror which has been inflicted on the ordinary Afghan civilians, whether it's through drone attacks or whether it's through operations. It's been an absolutely disgusting and dirty war. Of course, we've also seen the death of Donald Rumsfeld, who presided over the beginning of this war. Nobody's going to be remembering Donald Rumsfeld with any glee in Afghanistan. But Biden's decision to withdraw troops from Afghanistan is consistent with his view over the last 20 years about the war. I mean, he has been negative about it, although under Obama they did continue the war. It seems as though now, finally, the Americans are going to pull out. But they're also immediately trying to engineer bases surrounding Afghanistan, particularly Pakistan has been approached, and Imran Khan, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, categorically said, absolutely not, we won't be allowing American bases to do any kind of work in Afghanistan. And his argument was pretty sound. He said if the Americans could not bring peace and prosperity to Afghanistan while they had boots on the ground in the nation, how on earth are they going to do it from outside? So the immediate impact, of course, will have reverberations on Pakistan, on Iran, on Russia, on all the bordering powers that exist there. All of these regional powers will now be looking to see how they can influence what goes on in Afghanistan if an American withdrawal becomes total.
Richard Becker, the initial deadline was set in September, but there are talks of a full troop withdrawal by even as early as July 4th. Why is this all happening at such a rapid pace?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I mean, for one thing, there is a shift that's going on, an overall shift. Not that the U.S. is leaving the Middle East or leaving South Asia, but it's reorienting its military toward Asia, the pivot to Asia, and the extreme and growing hostility toward the People's Republic of China. If you follow to any extent the military websites, every day there's a discussion about new weaponry to be used against China and, you know, this all-domain plans of warfare and so forth. But you can see that this shift is going on. There's some really amazing things about this, that the U.S. is withdrawing its troops and the Afghan army and Afghan National Police, in some places, according to today's New York Times, in some provinces of Afghanistan, the troops are surrendering because they have no ammunition. They're out of ammunition. And this is after trillions of dollars have been spent. The level, in other words, the level of corruption is so high. The Times report also includes a reference to a poker game where it said, in Kabul, where it said that sometimes $120,000 is on the table. I mean, so this, where did the money go? Why is there so little improvement for the people? Why would the Afghan army not have ammunition? I mean, it's because it's the money has gone somewhere else. So we see this tremendously corrupt intervention that's taken place, and the corruption continues. And, you know, it's if we will see whether or not there is the kind of collapse that many in Afghanistan are anticipating.
Mr. Abbas, let's talk about some of the reactions to the withdrawal. Russia said that this should not turn into a redeployment of NATO military infrastructure in Central Asia. Do you think that Moscow has a point here? Maybe down the line, U.S. and NATO will assume that they should come back to Afghanistan.
It's entirely possible. It's such a kind of linchpin in terms of strategic, geostrategic value to all of the powers in that region. Let's start with China. I mean, we're talking about Russia, but the Eurasian axis, which China and Russia, as well as Iran, are very much a central part of course, also Pakistan, would all be impacted by whatever goes on in Afghanistan, because the roots of the Silk Road, if you like, or the Belt Road Initiative, do need to also pass through Afghanistan. So, of course, not only from a geo-military perspective, but also from a geo-economic perspective, Afghanistan is hugely important. And so I think that we're going to see the Americans, whilst they say they're moving out, they do have bases dotted around, I think, in various regions there. They can still cause trouble. And we know already the Russians are probably speaking on the back of intelligence, which tells them that the Americans have already flown in ISIS recruits. So ISIS, much of the ISIS forces that were pushed out of Iraq or Syria have been redeployed already in Afghanistan. So although the American military is pulling out, there's nothing to say that they can't use their Takfiri mercenaries in Afghanistan and that region. So yes, it's entirely possible that the Americans won't leave totally. It's said that 650 US troops will remain supposedly to safeguard embassies and other diplomatic staff in Kabul. The Taliban have responded saying they've got a right to react if the U.S. keeps troops in Afghanistan after September the 11th at all. So any troops are left after September the 11th, they give themselves the right to do what they think is necessary. Read into that what you like. I mean, those bases that they're trying to redeploy were very publicly rebuffed, as I mentioned, by Imran Khan, and Pakistan certainly doesn't want to get involved in supporting American intrusion. Of course, Pakistan, on the quiet, has at one hand been a partner of the U.S. and received funding for its war on terror, or so-called war on terror, but they at the same time have also been the primary backers of the Taliban. So Pakistan has a huge interest in Afghanistan. Its primary purpose was to make sure that the Indians weren't left behind as the proxy, if you like, force on behalf of the Americans. They had 30 or so consulates, the Indians, in Afghanistan at one point. So clearly something was going on, but the Indians, who are American allies, would dearly like to surround Pakistan on two fronts. So Pakistan has a huge say in this issue, and the Russians, of course, are going to be keeping a very wily eye. Iran, which is allied to Russia in many ways in terms of geopolitics of that region, and allied to China, will also have a major say. Traditionally, Iran has supported the Shia in the western part of Afghanistan. They've also, the Dari speakers, were very close to the Persian culture, the Iranian culture, I should say, and also they've had traditional links with the Northern Alliance. So the people who are in power at the moment, Iran has fairly good relations with them. So one would imagine that there's going to be some negotiating to do, but the Americans look like the way they're withdrawing so suddenly, want civil war. Perhaps there will be civil war. This is the danger.
Mr. Becker, what did the 20-year war cost the U.S., not just in terms of the money spent, but logistically, and of course, the human cost, troops and civilians both. What did it cost, and what did they achieve in return?
Well, the cost in human lives has been enormous, and human suffering. And that has been, of course, very disproportionately on the side of the Afghan people. I believe the UN didn't start keeping track of civilian deaths until 2009, and they as of a couple of years ago, a few years ago, they had recorded that there were 110,000 civilians who had been killed. I think that tens of thousands of Taliban have been killed, tens of thousands of military forces, Afghan National Police and Army. And I think that the estimates are all low. I think they're all very low. I think that, we hear it's 2,400 or so U.S. deaths and 20,000 and some wounded. But I think there are just tens of thousands. The 775 or 800,000 U.S. troops served at one time, and many of those multiple deployments. And I think that many of the injuries, psychological and physical injuries, have gone undiagnosed. And I think that goes for all sides. So I think there's a huge underestimate of the number of TBI, of traumatic brain injuries, of PTSD, the rate of violence for people coming back to the U.S., soldiers coming back, has been quite high. The rate of suicides has been quite high. And then all the damage that's been done to Afghanistan, immense amounts of bombing and destruction of civilian infrastructure. It would be built and destroyed and built and destroyed. So it's a terrible war. It's been a terrible war. It's been a terrible war for everyone who's been involved in it, and particularly, as you said, for the people of Afghanistan. It's been an unmitigated disaster.
And Mr. Abbas, regarding the civilian deaths, the ICC, they tried to pursue an investigation into the civilian casualties, but they were met with staunch opposition from Washington. Will there, in your opinion, be accountability for the victims and justice for their families?
If you look at the track record of American interventions across West Asia in particular, whether it's their gains in Syria that caused millions of deaths, or whether it's the Libyan fiasco, which is still ongoing with the actual disaster that they've caused there, whether you look at Iraq and the millions that have died, suffered, been left homeless and as refugees, etc., there's been no accountability for any of these folk. There's no accountability for the people who have been put in Guantanamo Bay, for instance. I think there's only 70 or so inmates left there, but of the 700 that were there, there's been no real justice for any of these folk. The Americans see themselves as above international law. Under Donald Trump, you saw that very starkly. They didn't feel it was a problem in any shape or form. They haven't been brought to account for their clear and open murder, assassination, or I call it extrajudicial killing of a major figure like Lieutenant General Soleimani. So figures who were killed openly in broad daylight, America doesn't get brought to task there. I shouldn't imagine that the kind of Afghan families that they've been bombing with their drones and various other weapons of mass destruction will have the kind of political weight to be able to get any kind of recourse to justice. We know what the Americans did at Abu Ghraib, in the prisons there in Iraq. But what's happened in Afghanistan has been buried a lot more deeply, because the way they've been killing them has always been touted as killing of terrorists. And of course, the whole world was on this, the whole secular Western imperialist world was on this bandwagon of the so-called war of terror. It was really a war of terror on the people of West Asia, Afghanistan, onwards. That's what it was all about. America is suffering defeat upon defeat in the region, though. The encouragement for the people of that region is that the axis of resistance is putting up a really strong resistance. The Taliban itself, although I don't think it's part of the axis of resistance, they've also, with the backing of Pakistan, I believe, done a pretty good job at making it very hard for the Americans to get anything out of Afghanistan. It's been an unmitigated disaster, an absolute defeat. They've not achieved any of the targets they set out for. Perhaps they got some funding out of the narcotics that they were smuggling through various channels out of the nation. Perhaps they got their hands on some of the riches that Afghanistan possesses, but it's very hard to extract most of the minerals and the multi-trillion dollar wealth that Afghanistan actually has. It's an awfully difficult area, and of course, if you've got a war going on, you can't do it either. So perhaps that's another one of the reasons that they've not been getting the economic return that they wanted out of Afghanistan, which has led them to withdraw temporarily or leave altogether. We don't know. That's not something that's written in stone. So I think never count your chickens before they hatch, as they say, and the Americans haven't left, leaving Bagram Airport. They seem to have the Turks and Erdogan wanting to come in and run the airport. He seems awfully keen on coming and doing some of NATO's work there. That's something would be very unadvisable for him, because the Taliban have already issued warnings saying to the Turks that, look, keep your business out of Afghanistan, otherwise you too may go the same way as the Americans.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. We're going to leave it there. Allow me to thank my guests, Mr. Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition, joining us from San Francisco. Also, thanks to journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas, who's with us from the British capital, London. Also, thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
فَأَخَذَتْهُمُ الصَّيْحَةُ بِالْحَقِّ فَجَعَلْنَاهُمْ غُثَاءً. للقوم الظالمين.
So the shriek seized them in truth, and we made them as plant stubble. Then away with the wrongdoing people.
Brothers and sisters, we were talking about 41st verse of this chapter. فَأَخَذَتْهُمُ الصَّيْحَةُ بِالْحَقِّ. So the blast overtook them with justice. فَجَعَلْنَاهُمْ غُثَاءً. We made them into a scum. فَبُعْدًا لِلْقَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ. So away with the unjust people. So in this section of the verses, in these group of verses of this chapter, the Almighty Allah talked about another generation after generation of Prophet Noah, the people of Thamud, their Prophet Salih. Also in the other verses of the Holy Quran, the sign of prophethood and miracle of this prophet is mentioned as the camel which came out from the middle of the mountain. But those people, only one of them killed and slaughtered this camel, and the people were all punished. In the beginning, al-mala'u min qawmi, the chiefs of the people of Salih, they disbelieved in him. They denied the meeting of hereafter. They had been given affluence in this life of the world, and this is the very reason they started to deny him. They started to disbelieve him. They started to conceive the others. They convinced the others that this is the man who drinks like you. This is the man who eats like you, and he cannot be a prophet. They misled the people. They tried to convince them that he is a mortal like you, and if you follow a mortal like you, you are certainly losers. And this is the very end, and this is what happens in conclusion to those people. فَأَخَذَتْهُمُ الصَّيْحَةُ بِالْحَقِّ. The blast overtook them with justice. And this, فَأَخَذَتْهُمْ, can be referring to not only the chiefs from among the people, but also the people that were misled. This generalized meaning can also be possible when we have a look at the end of this verse. فَبُعْدًا لِلْقَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ. This is a generalized part, because even the act of slaughtering the animal, the camel, was not individual, but collective and communal. And at the end of the verse, all oppressors in the course of history who share the same characteristics are mentioned to have the same fate. This is what awaits them.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Now, one part of the verse that is possibly remaining to be discussed is the meaning of غُثَاء. فَجَعَلْنَاهُمْ غُثَاءً.
so we made them into a scum. In the previous verses, we read that people of Thamud were made into Ghutha by the thunderbolt. The Arabic term Ghutha originally means dried plants in the form of an untidy pile of muck that float on floodwaters. And in addition to that, the scum produced in a boiling pot is also called Ghutha, to mean that this is literally nothing. It has the sense of nothingness in it. So likening their corpses to Ghutha indicates their extreme weakness, their frailty, their defeat, their worthlessness. Because straw on the floodwater are lighter and more trivial than anything there is, they have no choice in destination. After passing and subsiding of a flood, no trace of them remains. And this is the result. This is the conclusion of what happens to the unjust people. The people who have denied their prophets, the ones who have denied the prophethood of him, and the ones who have listened to these false reasonings. And the meaning can be understood more clearly by having a look at the 42nd verse, which we will talk about in the next program. أَنْشَأْنَا مِنْ بَعْدِهِمْ قُرُونًا آخَرِينَ. We brought forth other generations after them. This means that nothing remains of them but their history and the lessons we must take from the punishment of these people. We will, inshallah, talk about the 42nd verse in the next program. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Why? And that's when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Around the world with reporters.
Yemen's Ministry of Electricity held a sit-in protest in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a to call all the international community to step in and to pressure Saudi Arabia to stop detaining Yemeni oil vessels. The ministry said it is unable to generate power anymore due to the lack of fuel.
Electricity is an essential service and has nothing to do with any political conflicts. The power sector in Yemen has been heavily affected since the first moment of the war. The Saudi-led coalition has directly targeted all electric power plants, and this is a great tragedy for us. The UN has not done anything to end the suffering of Yemenis. We demand the lifting of the siege and releasing the oil ships so we can generate electricity again.
At the same place, Yemeni children organized a gallery for the drawings. The gallery was named The U.S. Kills Our Childhood and exhibited children's drawings that show the suffering of Yemeni children due to the ongoing conflict.
We participated in this protest to tell the United Nations, which classified Ansarullah in its blacklist of groups violating children's rights. We Yemenis demand our rights like any other people, on top of which is the lifting of the siege imposed on us by Saudi Arabia.
How many fathers and mothers have lost their children? This is a massive crime. This is tyranny. We are little children. We have no fault.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a devastating war on the impoverished country in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children, and imposing an all-out blockade.
Yemenis have held hundreds of protests here in front of the United Nations office, but the international body has not yet taken any strict measures to end the suffering of the millions of Yemenis. That is why the UN describes the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, is standing trial for allegations of culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, disruption of public peace, among other charges which the Islamic cleric has denied. Rounding up his address to the court, the leader of the defense team explained that the prosecution has not established any case against Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki. He said none of the people accused of the crimes attributed it to his client, and the court has released many of them.
If we feel that no prima facie case has been established against your client, you make a no-case submission, and that is what has happened in this case. So we are waiting for the ruling of the court.
The prosecution has presented a total of 15 witnesses, including Nigerian military officers. But Zazaki's defense team said all the witnesses that were brought before the court confirmed that they did not see Sheikh Zazaki during the attack by the army.
The prosecution called 15 witnesses. We felt that no case has been made to warrant our clients being asked to give evidence. In other words, we address the court to defend that there is nothing to defend on the part of our client.
The trial judge adjourned the case to July 28, when he is expected to deliver his ruling on the no-case submission by Zazaki's defense team. Sheikh Zazaki has been in detention since December 2015 after soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked his home and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters. Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria have continued with their protests, demanding the release of Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat. They have always insisted that the Islamic cleric is an innocent man who has suffered persecution by the Nigerian government. Anjum Abdullahi, Kaduna.
Bashir Ahmed Baba is a free man now. 12 years back, he was detained at the Gujarat state of India for a crime he was unaware of.
I used to work for a German-based NGO. I and my colleague, who was non-Kashmiri, had gone to attend a training workshop on children with disabilities. It was a two-week-long program, but I was detained on the sixth day while my colleague was set free.
Baba was detained under a controversial Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, or UAPA, and was accused of making bombs in soft drink cans.
I was unaware of what I was being questioned about. I even couldn't read the charge sheet because it was in the local language. But one thing I was sure about is that one day I would walk free, because I knew I was innocent. But I never knew it would take 12 years to prove it.
Unlawful activity is defined vaguely in the law as any action, whether by an individual or an association, which disclaims, questions, disrupts, or is intended to disrupt the sovereignty and territorial integrity of India, or causes or is intended to cause disaffection against India. According to the National Crime Records Bureau data, there's a rising graph of UAPA cases in Jammu and Kashmir. The UAPA law has come under stern criticism after several activists and journalists in India were booked under it by the Hindu nationalist Narendra Modi-led Bharatiya Janata Party. Scores of Kashmiris are languishing in the jails across India. Providing legal aid and frequent meeting with the prisoners has become a challenge for their families.
In these 12 years, I have seen him once, that only after I sold my gold earring. We were drained financially after his father died of cancer, so going to him was out of our bounds.
Analysts say unlawful detention is a violation of human rights, and the covenants of civil and political rights say such people need to be compensated for unlawful detention, and for those who have falsely implicated them also need to be tried in the name of malicious prosecution.
In India, in case of Muslims in general and Kashmiris in particular, the law enforcing authorities have been given a license to harass, implicate and detain without any cause. That is why we find Muslim population in India is just 15%, whereas 35% prisoners of India are Muslims, and most of them are falsely implicated.
Sheikh added, Kashmir is an exceptional case where New Delhi has placed laws that allow authorities to detain people without any reason. Baba is happy to be back and is rejoicing the reunion with his family members. However, is in a constant dilemma where and how to start fresh. Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
For the first time in decades, Canada Day celebrations have been mostly muted as the country sees old wounds reopened. Various cities scrapped the celebrations following a series of horrific discoveries of unmarked graves around former Catholic schools for Indigenous children. Calls to scale back or cancel celebrations snowballed in May and June when almost 1,000 unmarked graves were found. Another discovery this week, comprising 182 graves of children aged 7 to 15, made matters even worse. The new findings have fueled outrage in the country over a lack of information and accountability regarding violations of Indigenous people's rights. The graves remind people of the horrors experienced by thousands of kids that were supposed to be assimilated into the white society in church-run boarding schools. Rallies have been held to honor over 4,000 victims of Canada's infamous residential schools, while Indigenous leaders have been calling for a thorough investigation. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has described the discoveries as a shameful reminder of systemic racism and urged the Catholic Church to take responsibility. The Roman Catholic Church is yet to issue a formal apology. Activists, however, believe the government is trying to put the onus on the Catholic Church and downplay its central role.
The Canadian government currently is trying to kind of put the onus more on the Catholic Church, on the churches, but obviously the Canadian government is central to this whole horrific history and ongoing colonization.
Indigenous children are not the only victims of racism in Canada. Reports say thousands of Indigenous women and girls have been murdered or gone missing in the country over the past 30 years. The National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls says a genocide is being perpetrated. But that's not all. A deadly attack on a Muslim family last month in Ontario and attacks on women wearing hijab in Alberta testify to the fact that racism has deep roots in the Canadian society. A new opinion poll shows some 36% of the Indigenous people and 42% of minorities believe Canada is a racist country. Canada, a country with a dark colonial history, has for decades depicted itself as an outspoken critic of racism and a leading advocate of human rights. But the latest discoveries of Indigenous graves and attacks against Muslims show Canada is yet to take meaningful measures to root out racism in its own society.
Every year in late June and early July, Iranians flock to the graveyard in southern Tehran and sprinkle rose petals on tombs. Buried here are the victims of a terrorist attack in 1981 that bombed the central office of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, killing 73 key officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, who was viewed as the second man of the nascent Islamic Republic after its founder, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini.
I lost my father in the 1981 bombing of the Islamic Republic Party's headquarters. I was 9 back then. I still miss him so much, and I come here every year to commemorate him.
The killing of the Iranian politicians back then was a terrorist act that was supported by the U.S. The terrorists are now residing in France, so we ask the French government to hand them over to face justice.
The formidable Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization took responsibility for the 1981 bombing. Known as the MKO, the terror group has a history of assassinations against Iranian statesmen and civilians, killing at least 12,000 Iranians.
Ask any Iranian about the MKO, and they will call them munafiqin, the Persian word for hypocrites. This is because they call themselves the crusaders of people's cause, but in fact, they killed people to climb to power. What's even more ironic is the fact that the U.S. and some other Western countries nourish the MKO terrorists.
This man is believed to be the spearhead of the 1981 terror attack. After the incident, Mohammad Reza Kolahi sought refuge in the Netherlands under the false identity of Ali Mohtamed, where he was warmly accommodated until he was disposed of by the MKO in 2015.
When Mr. Kolahi fled Iran to the Netherlands, Iran asked the Netherlands to hand him over, but it didn't do so. This shows that the West has a selective approach to terrorism.
This is not where the West's support for the terror group ends. In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist organization. Following this measure, the group was relocated from its former stronghold at a U.S. military base in Iraq to Albania and France. Ever since, the MKO has held regular meetings with American and European officials. The 1981 assassination of Iranian officials, along with other similar events, such as the 1988 downing of an Iranian passenger plane by the U.S. Army and Iraq's chemical bombardment of Sardasht, falls in the same time frame, between June 26th and July the 3rd. U.S. footprints can be traced in all of the incidents. That's why Iran has designated this period as the Week of American Human Rights, as a jab that questions the U.S. double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
China is building up nearly 3,000-kilometer-long network of roads, railway lines, and investing tens of billions of U.S. dollars in Pakistan's energy and infrastructure projects under its mega Belt and Road global initiative. The major road infrastructure links western China to Deep Gwadar Port in southwest of Pakistan, 75 kilometers east of Iran at the top of Arabian Sea. The U.S. feels threatened over expansion of Chinese economic influence in the rest of the world through Gwadar Port, which also serves as an alternative option for Beijing in the event of military blockade of Chinese Navy in South China Sea by the U.S. and its allies. The U.S. has been pressurizing Pakistan into shelving Chinese mega projects, calling it a debt trap. Washington has been struggling hard to win over Islamabad in its what appears to be a cold war with Beijing over growing Chinese economic influence in the world.
Pakistan thinks that it is very unfair for the U.S. or other powers, Western powers, for countries like us to take sides. Why do we have to take sides?
It's not going to happen that if Pakistan is, if there's pressure put on Pakistan to change its relationship or downgrade its relationship with China, it won't happen. Our relationship between the two countries, no matter what pressure is put on us, is not going to change.
We do not expect that living at the backyard of such a rising power, which happens to be luckily our strategic partner, how could we downgrade our relation with them and side or be more close with someone who's 10,000 miles away? So it is very unrealistic to expect of Pakistan. Militarily, we would not involve ourselves in the conflicts of the region.
The unprecedented cold shouldering to the U.S. has followed series of Pakistan's policy decisions to no longer get itself involved in any U.S.-driven military conflict across the region. Islamabad has outrightly rejected the U.S. request to set up military bases in Pakistan. The American CIA chief, William Byrne, who was on a secret visit to Pakistan a few weeks ago, was reportedly snubbed upon his request to see Prime Minister to reconsider his decision on military bases. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Aside from the enormous death toll, COVID-19 has wreaked economic havoc across the 27-nation EU. The Brussels Economic Forum, the European Commission's flagship annual event, focusing on the economy has just heard that young people have been disproportionately impacted.
We have a whole generation of youth that have had their education and their early labor market careers disrupted. So we really have to pay attention to those groups and try to move forward better.
Apparently, the EU is ill-equipped to create jobs because it's behind the curve when it comes to the digital technology sector.
Before, we were just lagging behind the United States and Japan at some stage. Now we are lagging behind the US and China.
Education systems in the EU need to be reformed so that young people can receive training for quality jobs, it has been suggested.
If you're from the north of Europe or the south of Europe, the east of the west, young people desire one thing. They want to build their future, they want to build a family, and this comes with a quality job.
The EU's handling of the coronavirus pandemic was criticized at the Brussels Economic Forum. A senior official recalls Russian medical supply trucks rolling into his home country of Italy in February 2020.
They had written in the tracks from Russia with love, and that in the same weeks we had export bans of medical equipment among European countries.
The EU's slow response to the pandemic has economic consequences, experts point out.
The United States, earlier than Europe, made huge progress on vaccines as soon as Joe Biden came into office. It also put forward an even bigger economic recovery package.
The event heard that Western nations rely too heavily on the arms industry and financial services sector when it comes to growing GDP. That's the total monetary value of any given country.
In contrast, imagine a good society, a harmonious one, where people feel safe, where they are healthy.
Contributors reminded the Economic Forum the EU was still struggling from the 2008 financial crisis when COVID-19 arrived. They warn if citizens are not treated better this time, the EU will fall apart. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Pentagon confirmed it carried out airstrikes in positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units on both sides of the country's border with Syria. The Pentagon claimed the Sunday night strikes were defensive and in retaliation for what it called the PMU's drone attacks on U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq. But the PMU forces roundly rejected any involvement. They said they are part of Iraq's regular armed forces and that the soldiers who died in the U.S. raids were guarding the border. The PMU forces warned that they are ready to take revenge. The U.S. airstrikes are the second of their kind to be ordered by President Joe Biden against the PMU since he took office in January. Biden says the strikes are meant to end what he calls forces attacks on U.S. interests, but Iraqis see things differently.
The Iraqi people, government, officials, factions, and political figures see this attack as a boon to Daesh and other terrorists in Iraq and Syria. Through this attack, the U.S. seeks to weaken PMU forces in Iraqi and Syrian border areas so that Daesh terrorists can enter the Iraqi territory and carry out terrorist attacks. Effectively, the U.S. is now standing united with Daesh against the people of Iraq and its interests.
The strikes have been condemned across the political spectrum in Iraq. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi denounced the airstrikes as a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraq's sovereignty and its national security. The Iraqi military also issued a rare statement saying the U.S. move was a breach of the country's sovereignty. Different factions in the Iraqi parliament also condemned the airstrikes and called for steps to ensure such attacks will not repeat. They say the solution is ending the U.S. military presence in Iraq. That would be in line with a resolution adopted by the Iraqi parliament in January 2020, which called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. The Iraqi parliament passed a resolution days after the U.S. assassinated Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani, along with a deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes, in an airstrike near Baghdad Airport. The U.S. has carried out more airstrikes on PMU positions ever since. During the period, Daesh terrorists have been the only other perpetrator of attacks on the popular forces.
The 10th session of the Islamic Radios and Televisions Union, hosted by the Iranian broadcaster, the IRIB. The event brought together representatives of 300 television and radio channels from 33 member states who attended the event through video conference. This year, the session was held with the motto of media justice and freedom of speech.
The 10th General Assembly of the Islamic Radios and Televisions Union comes as the websites of several of its affiliated media outlets were seized by the U.S. government. something which the union views as an attempt to silence dissenting voices.
Last week, the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation confiscated the websites of Press TV and 36 other Iranian and regional media outlets for what it described as a means to combat disinformation. Addressing the ceremony in Tehran, head of the IRIB, Abdul Ali Ali Askari, condemned the U.S. move as an open violation of freedom of expression, calling it a failed attempt to muzzle the truth.
The extent of the effectiveness of resistance media outlets prompted the U.S. government to breach its own norms regarding free speech and take down those media. So this shows that those media have been successful. But the West must know that their move indicates their weakness, and on the other hand, the seized media will not stop working.
The Islamic Radios and Televisions Union is a multinational entity, which is currently comprised of 228 member media outlets from 33 countries, covering a total of 22 different languages. The main goal of the union is to break the Western monopoly on media and to offer an alternative narrative for regional and global developments, as opposed to the narrative presented by mainstream media. The union says the West has engaged itself in a full-scale media war to silence the alternative voices.
The slogan of freedom of expression is just a tool for the West to impose its will on different countries. Those media outlets that speak the truth and enlighten the minds of the world nations face censorship just because they expose truths that come at the expense of Western interests.
Head of the IRIB World Service, Peyman Jebeli, says the West can no longer pull the plug on the resistance media since they have already reached global audience, including Western societies.
This time, we witnessed global solidarity with the people of Palestine in their resistance against Israel. Hundreds of thousands of people in Chicago, London, and elsewhere in the West voiced their support for Palestinians. Does the U.S. think it can prevent the voices of Palestine resistance from reaching America by blocking our media outlets?
The Islamic Radios and Televisions Union says any attempt by the West to take down independent media is doomed to failure, and they will continue to shed light on the truth. However, member media outlets say they will sue the U.S. for its illegal media crackdown and will take measures to restore the seized websites. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
انسان را مطمئن می کند این ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Allah ya Allah subhanallah. Allah ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allah wa la ilaha illa I invite you to listen to a short part of the book Sirrussalat, The Secret of Prayer by Imam Khomeini. It is on the secrets of intention, and that is to the common people is to decide to obey, who forsake their beds to cry unto the Lord in fear and hope, and spend of that we have bestowed on them. And to the learned ones, it is to decide to obey, worship Allah as if you see him, then if you don't see him, he sees you. And to the people of liking and attraction is to decide to obey. Muhammad, the Prophet, said the best people are those who love worshiping.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Today we are with another program of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. And I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi. Imam Khomeini talks about a wrong selection, or if a person who does not care about the Islamic rules or laws. Imam Khomeini says the day perversion is witnessed in the majlis, which is the parliament, when perversions of power seeking and greed are observed in the president or the ministers know that day marks our impending defeat. Perversions must be checked right then and there.
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.